You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, September 19th, 2016.
We need to stop the marriage between psychiatry and schools. I think people have greatly underestimated not only how it hurts the person who's being drugged, but how it affects the classmates, how it affects the joy of everybody in the community.
MCCSE School Board District 4 candidates discuss preparing students for success later in the show in today's community report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we speak with court-appointed special advocates. That's on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, these local headlines.
Bloomington police have changed their minds about the connection between several recent break-ins, one of which involved a rape. Last week, police arrested 28-year-old Devin Grounds and charged him with breaking into an apartment on September 5th at Knight's Landing on North Walnut Street. Grounds is accused of raping a woman, threatening to kill her, and stealing her cell phone. For the past 11 days, police were clear they didn't believe the Knight's Landing incident was connected to four other break-ins that occurred in Bloomington around the same time. Those four break-ins all involved a masked man who entered through unlocked doors. In all four incidents, the masked man encountered women who were able to scare him off. Today, Bloomington police announced they now believe there may be a connection between all the incidents, which occurred within 3 days of each other. In a statement, police said they discovered Devin Grounds' DNA at the scene of one of the break-ins on East Melrose Avenue. Grounds has now been charged in that case. They say Grounds is now a possible suspect in the three other break-ins as well.
A live alligator was found yesterday evening on Interstate 465 in Indianapolis. Indiana State Troopers responded to reports of a 2-foot-long alligator on the shoulder of the road. When they found the alligator, there were injuries indicating the alligator may have been thrown out of a moving car. The alligator died from the injuries before animal control could arrive on the scene. Alligators are only native to southern states, meaning that unless the animal was someone's pet, it could have traveled over 1,000 miles before being abandoned in Indiana.
New data from the Census Bureau shows Indiana continuing to recover from the recession, but still behind pre-recession levels. The overall poverty rate in Indiana dropped from 15.2% to 14.5%, which breaks down to 41,000 fewer Hoosiers living below the poverty line. But not all Hoosiers benefited equally. Jessica Frazier of the Indiana Institute for Working Families says Indiana still lags behind its neighbors in child poverty, a persistent issue for the state.
So while we, you know, made a good decrease in poverty, when you break some of those stats out on poverty, particularly the stat of child poverty and elder poverty, we're not doing as well as maybe the state, the national average, and some other states are doing. The child poverty one is particularly concerning because we've been talking about that for years, and everyone's working on the issue, and we had no statistically significant change from last year. So it's sad, you know, it's disheartening not to see that needle moving at all, especially when we know that progress was made, you know, at the national level and in other states.
Child poverty did not see a statistically significant decrease last year, even though almost all other categories of poverty improved. Additionally, despite some improvements in 2015, Indiana still has huge disparities across racial, ethnic, and gender lines. Black children in the state are impoverished at 3 times the rate that white children are, and the poverty rate for Hispanic children is twice as high as whites. Overall, 1 in 5 children in Indiana live in poverty. Jessica Frazier argues that this isn't just a problem of slow economic growth, it's the result of deliberate policy choices.
so many of the policies that you might not even realize affect kids, because if you can't get the whole, you have to think about the two generationally, you have to think about the whole family. And if you can do that, then you can move the needle on child poverty. And then when we start thinking about specific policy decisions, you know, one of the things that I would point to is our temporary assistance for needy families policies. You know, we have eligibility guidelines that are pretty tricky for families. It's very, very low income eligibility, below 50% of the federal poverty guidelines. There's a job search component. And so I think the most recent numbers that came out of CBPP were that 8 in 100 poor Hoosiers were receiving any type of cash assistance.
Cash assistance for the poor is nearly extinct in Indiana. Even though the state receives block grants from the federal government for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, less than 10% of that money actually gets spent on cash assistance. Cash payouts have plummeted in recent years as the state has toughened eligibility and work requirements. Most TANF money is spent on child care, tax credits, administration, and other non-assistance activities. One bright spot in the census data is an increase in access to health insurance. 90% of Hoosiers now have health insurance, up from 88% in 2014. Indiana is virtually tied with the national average for obtaining health insurance, mostly due to the state agreeing to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and the rollout of the Healthy Indiana Plan.
Members of the Ellettsville Town Council last week debated whether to approve a $150 fee to obtain copies of video footage from police body cameras and dash cams. The $150 charge is the maximum allowed by law and has already been adopted by the City of Bloomington. Ellettsville Police Chief Jimmy Durnell told the council his department has invested $4,000 in processing equipment, though he said they have not yet provided any copies of footage. Council President Scott Oldham, who also works as a captain with the Bloomington Police Department, said reviewing and copying footage is a time-consuming process. Oldham went on to recommend the town approve the $150 charge per recording.
The $150, that would be eaten up within the first, you know, 2-3 hours potentially, if we factor in how much the yearly cost of some of these programs is going to be, or the outright purchase of them, because I know that some of them are $20,000-$30,000 or more just to buy the program, or $7,000 or $8,000 a year to use the online version of said program. And then depending upon how many requests he gets for them, he also has to have storage for what has been redacted and what is evidence. So it's not just as simple as redacting it and throwing it back in the pile. You have to keep both copies of it, and some of those copies have to be kept for a decade or longer.
Council member Kevin Ferris agreed with Oldham. Council member Scott Thomas said he'd rather see officers on the road than processing records requests, which prompted a discussion about the feasibility of outsourcing the footage to a third party for the processing.
Is that worse than the, as you mentioned, $20,000 to buy it, or $7,000 or $8,000 to do the online? I mean, I think we should research our options and let them take that. Because $20,000 to buy it, if you're making a whole industry out, or a whole business out of it, is a drop in a bucket. Versus us, I mean, do we have that built into our police budget? I think it's worth looking at.
Oldham cautioned against outsourcing camera footage for redaction and copying.
Under this law, once we provide this video, we don't control it. So it could very well wind up anywhere. You know, it could very well go to YouTube instantly. And while that's not a bad thing, it just is, a reminder that we absolutely have to be certain we have met every criteria under the law that we redact before we release it, because it could very well go on a wide scale and do harm if we don't do it correctly.
Councilmember Thomas said he was not yet comfortable with defaulting to the maximum charge of $150 per record. He and Councilmember Brian Mobley voted in favor of tabling the issue so further research could be done to find a more exact cost to the city to process the camera footage. Councilmembers Scott Oldham and Kevin Ferris voted against tabling the issue. Councilmember Diana Baston was absent. In the case of a tie vote, Clerk Treasurer Sandra Hash is allowed to vote. Hash said she couldn't see charging less than $150.
I mean, if you take an employee's hourly wage plus their benefit package, I mean, you're talking 3 to 4 hours maximum just to reach that without any equipment or tape fees or, you know, material cost at all. So I'll vote no.
Ferris moved to adopt the $150 flat fee per recording, which again resulted in a tied vote. Hash broke the tie by voting in support of the charge. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. This fall, voters are being asked to decide three contested races for Monroe County School Board seats. Sue Wanzer is facing competitor Jim Billingsley for her District 2 seat. Lois Sabo-Skelton is defending her seat against candidate Martin Speckler. And in District 4, candidates Kathy Fuentes-Rohrer and Jim Shackelford are competing for the seat being vacated by David Sabah. Assistant News Director Sarah Vaughn spoke with District 4 candidates Fuentes-Rohrer and Shackelford as part of WFHB's Candidate Forum series. We bring you an excerpt of that conversation for today's Community Report.
I'm Sarah Vaughn, and I'm here with candidates Kathy Fuentes-Rohrer and Jim Shackelford. Jim, what improvements do you think MCCSC could make to better prepare kids for success in the 21st century?
Where I would put the emphasis is where my campaign has put the emphasis. We need to stop the marriage between psychiatry and schools. I think people have greatly underestimated not only how it hurts the person who's being drugged, but how it affects the classmates, how it affects the joy of everybody in the community.
Could you explain what you mean by the marriage between psychiatry and schools?
Well, if you go back to, say, 1970, there basically were not psychiatric diagnoses being placed upon children. By the 80s, this starts to grow pretty much. By the 90s, you have a marriage where people are thinking, they're using jargon like learning outcomes, and they're thinking that you can say that somebody has an arbitrary disorder decided one year by the APA at its conference called ADHD. Actually, they didn't call that originally, but they brought it in a later name to make it sound more technical. So you have people saying, we can get better learning outcomes by using these medications. By medications, they use drugs. So it's a marriage. We have over 8 million young people in this country on psychiatric drugs. They're all students of preschoolers. So when we talk about a school district and we dodge that huge problem, and then we say, well, how can we make our school district better? There's a real disconnect there. Number one, on an individual level, it's mistreatment of one child to do this to them. So number one, it has to be approached on that. And number two, if you want to improve a school district, get the psychiatric diagnosis out of there. Let the people be people again.
So I'm sorry, I distracted you from the original question. Was there anything else you wanted to comment on about how the school corporation could better prepare kids for the 21st century?
Well, if we do that, as I said, if we do that, I think what you're going to see is not only among students, but among parents, teachers, superintendent, everybody, you're going to see better thinking across the board, because there's a lot of guilt and shame underneath the surface because people haven't addressed this issue. This is serious mistreatment. Number two, what we were talking about before with things from the state. I mean, if we fund our schools, if we get rid of these weird pressures we've injected because governors and legislators forgot what schools are about, then, you know, I think those are three things. The other thing I'd say is let teachers teach. That sounds too general, but it's not a school board member's job to kind of get in there and shift the curriculum and stuff. Do I have, you know, I've written science curriculum for a school. Do I have opinions on curriculum? Sure. But as I understand our school district, we don't need me as a school board member getting in there and tinkering with small issues.
Kathy, what improvements do you think the school corporation could make to better prepare kids for the 21st century?
Well, that 21st century thing is a big talking point for it, but it's a reality. You know, when you look at the things that kids need, a lot of people have this talking point that that we need to have kids that have adaptability and are flexible, that we don't know what the jobs are going to be, you know, next year, let alone 10 years from now. You know, what we want is kids who are critical thinkers, who are able to resolve conflict. We forget, like, what the purpose of education is, I think, sometimes. I mean, the purpose, in my mind, and I guess we could have a whole community conversation about what we think the purpose is. If you listen to one faction or section of our community, they'll say it's to create workers for an economy like our governor. We'll talk about that for the global economy. But I think the real purpose for public education is for our democracy. And what do we need from citizens of a democracy? We need our kids to be able to not just have the reading, writing, and arithmetic and the knowledge that way, but we want them to be able to be creative, to think outside the box, to be kind, to be able to resolve conflict with each other. And kids learn this through play, through projects, through all kinds of things. And of course, as a school board member, it's not my job to dictate curriculum. I agree with that. But I think that school board members are supposed to be listening to the community, being transparent about their answers, and or their decision-making, rather, and be getting feedback, because we sort of create the vision that the school district is going to carry out. And so we need to be able to have good processes in place to hear back from the community and create that vision and make those decisions together as much as possible.
So let me ask you, Jim, what is the most significant issue you think the MCCSC school board will face in 2017?
Psychiatric drugs, if we face it at all, is the most significant one, because it hasn't been faced. So people are going to have all kinds of feelings. There's all kinds of confusion in our society that's built up over the last four decades. That's not just big in our school district. That's big across the nation. It's undealt with. I would like to see us be the first school district, the first community, where all the adults, you know, basically agree, we're not going to do this to children, we're not going to inflict these diagnoses on them, we're not going to tell them these drugs or medications. As I said before, if we hit that one, you're going to see a lot of good changes in becoming a more joyful, a more intelligent, more rational, fun-loving community.
Kathy, what's your response to the question, what is the most significant issue you think the MCCSC school board will face in 2017?
Well, the biggest issue that the school board will face in 2017 would be if we don't pass the referendum, then we will have to lay off something like 81 teachers. And that is something that I really hope I don't have to do. That we don't have to, I don't have to be a part of a conversation where we've lost that those millions of dollars and we have to decide what to cut, our arm or our leg, basically. But if we are successful at passing this referendum on election day, then I think part of it is still the continued threat to public education. And so we need to do, there's a definite attack on public schools. They're redirecting funding. They never gave the $300 million back that they cut in 2009. So every year, schools across the state are working with that deficit in their budget that should have been there. And then after that, there's been so many laws passed that have bled our funding to charter schools, to vouchers, and it will continue to do that if the people that are at the state level remain in power. And so our challenge is to do what we can to engage our community, to make our schools fulfill the promise that public education is, which is to serve every child, and to make people feel such a part of our community schools that they won't be willing or wanting to have other options or to vote for people who will take away the funding and thus the programs for all children.
I'm Sarah Vaughn, and I've been talking with candidates Kathy Fuentes-Rower and Jim Shackelford. Thank you again for your time, both of you.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you both.
WFHB's candidate forums will air as part of our Wednesday night lecture series, Standing Room Only. You can hear our full conversation with MCCSC District 4 candidates Kathy Fuentes-Rower and Jim Shackelford on Wednesday, September 28th at 6 p.m.
Now it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference, volunteer.
Hi, I'm Jim Shelton. I'm a volunteer with CASA, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and I'm also a board member. CASA's mission is to advocate for children who are in the court system because their parents have either abused or neglected them. The need is really dire right now. We have almost 100 children who are waiting for a CASA. They're in the court system. The system determined they are in need of services, but we don't have enough CASAs to give them. Our whole juvenile judicial system is under stress because of the opioid explosion around the country. So we don't have near enough CASAs, near enough foster homes. The Department of Child Services has had to go from 24 to 41 employees here in Monroe County. And there's just a real need for people to step forward and volunteer and to help with these children to go through the court system so they don't fall through the cracks, so they're in the system as short an amount of time as is possible, and to make sure they end up with good decisions being made about what services they need and what needs to be done for them. The judge, Judge Galvin, is our juvenile court judge, and he's wonderful. And he makes it clear how much he depends on the CASA involved in the case to tell him what's going on with the children, with their parents, with the foster situation, if that's what where the children are, and what services they need. The commitment is from 15 to 20 hours a month. They ask a person volunteering to be a CASA to commit for 2 years because it typically will take somewhere over a year for a case to be resolved. So they like to try to avoid turnover as much as possible. One of the strong points of a CASA is we typically don't turn over, and DCS is turning over, we hear, 30%. But I've been on cases where there have been five different DCS people involved in the course of 3 years. You sort of know that there are problems with children, that children do up in the court, end up in the court system, but until you volunteer and get involved, you have no idea how bad things are, how many children there are, how badly they may be treated, or quite often, because of the opioid explosion, they're just being not taken care of. They're just being ignored. Their parents are asleep on the couch all day. They don't get to school, or they get to school late. It's been a real revelation as to how bad things are. On the other hand, it's very gratifying when you are able to work with the parents, and a lot of times the parents really, well, probably almost all the time the parents really care, but an awful lot of time they can really get it together and work on their addiction. And it's really wonderful to see the kids either end up back with them and you feel they're going to be safe, or to see the system recognize they are not going to be able to get their act together and to move on then toward adoption, so the children end up in a good, safe, happy place. Kids are really resilient. It's amazing. You really don't save the world. You don't make everything wonderful, but you can see you've made things better. But I just hope people would think about it. I mean, the kids really, really need a CASA if they're in the court system. Thanks for listening. Again, I'm Jim Shelton, and I'm here on behalf of the Court-Appointed Special Advocates, or CASAs. Thank you.
You may visit the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network website to see a full organization profile at bloomington.in.gov/volunteer. Now here's a rundown of current volunteer opportunities in Bloomington and Monroe County.
For the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake with ways that you can get trained to offer your volunteer time within the justice system. CASA is seeking a long-term relationship of at least 2 years with community members aged 21 and older who care about children, are interested in learning about family dynamics, the juvenile court system, and how to write reports for the judiciary. View upcoming training dates online. The Community Justice and Mediation Center offers a 48-hour training program for those interested in learning about conflict resolution, mediation, and restorative justice. At the end of this course, you will be qualified to be a volunteer mediator with CJAM. And the Protective Order Assistance Partnership is seeking a committed community volunteer to serve as a protective order assistant, to provide help to victims of sexual violence, domestic violence, and stalking who are seeking orders of protection from the Monroe County Circuit Court. A minimum 6-month commitment is required, and training is provided. And that's a look at just some of the ways you can connect to your community through volunteering. For WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford, Leah Carter, and Jared Dill, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, our partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Activate is produced by Jennifer Brooks, along with the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Jennifer Brooks. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Now stay tuned for Bring It On, our local forum on African American people and culture, coming up next on WFHB.